Okay, we're back on the record. So we have Exhibit 121. We're striking Sections 13 and 14.
Correct.
We have two additional exhibits coming in at 122 and 123. Counsel for the city, having just received 121, you can reserve the right to object to 121, 122, and 123 until they come in.
Okay.
Tomorrow morning?
Yes.
Okay. And
But I would observe they have PDFs of all of them in front of them.
Except for the notes.
Right.
We have a hard copy you just gave us.
Yes. Right. No problem.
Okay. How much time do you need for, it's either 35 minutes from now or tomorrow morning. So
yes, tomorrow morning.
I think we're okay. They're not gaining too much. Questions?
So speaking of notes, I was at, so Mr. Thaler prepared notes for his testimony. I was going to provide them when he completed his testimony, but given your request for 12 hours, I give you now, you'll have many more than 12 hours before it's crossed.
If you have a copy, then.
Yeah, so why don't I give you those
okay. Now?
Thanks.
And do you want me to have them marked as an exhibit now or wait till Mr. Thaler comes back on?
We can just mark them now. All right. Now that it's going to matter. Yeah. It's going to be
right.
Messy now or later.
Yeah, I know.
So we'll do 124 for Mr. Thaler's notes. And we were finished with direct.
Other than his Fremont tree.
Yes. All right, let's go ahead. This clock is not working. We are recording. And Ms. Johnson will let me know if the recording stops for some reason. But she'll let me know also when we get up to 5 o'clock. Let's go ahead with Cross.
Okay. I'm Jeff Weber with the City Attorney's Office. Just a few questions on cross-examination. Going to the Exhibit 122, which was your table, just a couple questions on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I see here you've got, the title here is Existing Affordable Units at Risk for Displacement, and you've got a number of properties here that the ownership is given as SHA, which I assume is Seattle Housing Authority,
mm-hmm.
and CHH, which I assume is Capitol Hill Housing.
Yes, sorry about that.
But there are many others here that are listed as being under private property ownership, and the administration of the subsidized units is listed as being private. Can you explain what government program it is in these cases where the notation is private that resulted in the covenant?
Yeah. I wish I had another column that had a little bit more information, and I didn't think it was as relevant. I would have to look up specific properties, but in general, I would say that it varies so if you look down at the bottom, one of the other databases that I used was the HUD Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program database. That's sometimes referred to as LIHTC. So a lot of these fall into that category, but not all of them I was able to find the actual covenants. So also on the bottom, I mention here that one of the resources that I use is a website called apartmentfinder.com, which I was directed to by the Office of Housing, and it's on their website. And it's listed as a resource listed on the Seattle of Housing website that is a nonprofit clearinghouse for affordable apartment communities throughout Washington State. So it's one of the tools that the city provides residents who are trying to find affordable housing. And you can go to Apartment Finder and type in a zip code that you want to live in, and it lists all of the direct subsidized units in that zip code, and then each one has a whole page of information, and it describes the percentage of the area median income that you need to, the income requirements, and on that page it does, most of them have some information of whether it's this LIHTC funding or the some other funding. And I have to admit, I am not a technical expert, and I was trying to my best to wrap my mind and understanding around what all the various programs included. And the net of my research was that it was highly complex and not easy to just say, well, that's HUD and that's Office of Housing.
Okay. And then further down on the page, you've got the heading total number of at-risk existing affordable units, units mm-hmm. in privately owned business buildings, not SHA, CHA, mm-hmm. et cetera, that risk redevelopment. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by risk redevelopment? What caused a unit to be, in your view, at risk of
right.
redevelopment?
Good question. That number and that language that I used there was really – I created this for our meeting with Councilmember Sawant. And this was all in service of us trying to understand what affordable units we have in our neighborhood and would they ever possibly go away or are they protected in perpetuity. So we were trying to do a blanket distinction here of how at risk are they. And lacking more specific information on the covenant and when the covenant expires, we then at least went back to, well, we can for sure say whether it's privately held or whether it's in the hands of Seattle Housing Authority or Capitol Hill Housing. And so in our minds, a privately held property is less protected than something that is owned and operated by one of the nonprofit public housing developers. So that's just our own definition of what we felt could be at risk.
But is it the case that if the unit was in a privately owned building and it was within the Madison Miller Urban Village, it, in your view, fell within this risk redevelopment category?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So can you turn to page 3.36 of the EIS?
Where are the pages? I might need help.
So I just wanted to ask, because you were raising the question of mm-hmm. the covenants.
Yes.
Can you see about halfway through the second paragraph where it starts most subsidized housing?
The second paragraph?
Second paragraph of
most
the page.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just read where it starts?
Yes.
Most subsidized housing.
Most subsidized housing, except for the MFTE, has a very long term of affordability of 50 years or greater. And when those long-term affordability covenants expire, Office of Housing reports that housing affordability covenants are usually extended. The pool of subsidized, you want me to keep going?
Just, you can read that last sentence
okay.
too there.
The pool of subsidized housing is likely an important factor contributing to the relatively stable share of very low-income households in Seattle.
Does that address your question of how long these covenants typically might last?
To me, that is very general. And after spending 5 hours of trying to find specific protective covenant information and not finding any, I called the Office of Housing back and I said, I know you spent 2 hours trying to help me figure this out and I still can't find any records outlining these covenants. Can you tell me specifically more information about them? And again, she spoke in general terms that they're usually protected for 50 years. But as a concerned citizen, I guess I would like more assurance that the city is tracking on the complexity of how these units are held, when exactly they expire. I did find a couple, and I'm sorry I don't have them outlined of which ones, but two of them I found actually had a 12-year protective covenant and not 50. And so that left me wondering, well, what is all of the, what's the complexity and how much does it vary? And I unfortunately wasn't able to answer that with my own research on my kind of volunteer hours.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Yeah.
Redirect.
Do you remember looking at the spreadsheet of that we that David Ward and I dug up? It had beginning dates for the establishment of those covenants, didn't it?
I'd have to look.
Yeah.
No, I can't be certain of that.
Thank you, Ms. Harris.
Thank you.
Now let's have one last witness for the day.
Yes.
Partially.
Oh, Maria Valle. There's two of them.
No. This is the right one, because it has the legend on it. So put it in front.
Please state your name.
My name is Maria Batiola. B as in boy, A-T-A-Y-O-L-A.
And if you will also spell your first name, please.
Maria, M-A-R-I-A.
And do you swear or affirm that the testimony you will provide in today's hearing will be the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Could you please state your name and where you live?
My name is Maria Batiola. I live at 15353 Southeast 49th Place, Bellevue, Washington.
And how long have you lived in the Seattle area?
I've lived in Seattle since my parents brought me to the United States when I was 14. That's in 1969 until 6 years ago.
But you still live in... You're still active in the Seattle community.
I'm very active. I do my community work 6 to 7 days a week in Seattle because of my ties with the Central District, the Chinatown International District, and Beacon Hill. I'm also a property owner, and my family, my son, and his beloved live in Beacon Hill in my house.
Okay. Could you summarize your work background and experience?
Sure. My educational background is I have a bachelor's in political science and a bachelor's in theater from the University of Washington, and I have a master's in organizational development from LIOS. My career is 30 years of working in equity programs. I led the programs in Metro, King County, and then the merge King County and Metro. And then I worked for the City of Seattle, Seattle Center, as a human resources manager, where I led the race and social justice program for our director.
Okay, describe, you just mentioned a race and social justice program. That's what we're going to focus on. But before getting to that, you mentioned a couple other experiences and expertise that you've had. Community engagement and other related. Can you describe that a little bit?
Sure. Within the 30 years of working on equity and access programs, I started out as an affirmative action officer too, which is auditing Title VI, Title VII. That's a civil rights program, civil rights law, and for the state 503 and 504, which is disability accommodation and employment. And then I developed the Americans with Disabilities Act program at King County, the anti-harassment program, the certainly ran affirmative action, recruitment, outreach to the community. Because of language and culture, we've had to do particular ways of reaching out. And the last 4 years that I worked in King County, I developed a program called Cross-Cultural Competency, wherein I assisted departments redesign their programs so they can be accessible to people of color communities and immigrant communities.
And how does that work come into play in your work with the Beacon Hill Council on land use?
I chair the Beacon Hill Council, and in October of 2015, the City of Seattle reached out to Beacon Hill Council to talk about the HALA, Housing Affordability and Livability Act, and they wanted our feedback. Two of the focus items back then is the expansion of the urban village and the establishment of mandatory housing affordability areas. In that, the skills that I have play out because Beacon Hill has 35,000 residents, about 12,500 households, close to 80% people of color, 44% immigrant and refugee, 36% have limited English speaking capacity. So the question that was brought to us, we as council members really did not know the answer. And what we did, what I did is I wrote a grant from the Department of Neighborhoods to be able to develop a six language survey that would speak to the urban village and its expansion, the mandatory housing affordability. Back then it was a program that the city was looking at. The ordinance was not drafted yet, from my understanding. Asking in a survey elements of our neighborhood plan, such as the types of housing, the income levels for housing, and then priorities, emerging priorities. So the community engagement is multi-level in terms of we developed a six-language survey that was mailed to 12,500 households, and along with that is an online survey. We received 9% return, which is very good for what is called a survey that does not have incentives. Like, we didn't have a self-addressed stamped envelope for people to return it to us. They had to literally tear the language that they want, write it in, find an envelope, put a stamp on it to return to us. And I believe about 14% of the returns, both online and hard copy, are in languages other than English.
And what was the...
Go ahead. There was also community engagement. When we would go to, we had six partners, International Drop-In Center, El Centro de la Raza, we had Beacon Hill Merchants Association, Friends of Lewis Park, and I'm forgetting, there were two more, because we wanted to have coverage, some depth of permutation into the community.
And what was the specific trigger or subject? What kind of questions were being asked? What was the point?
The point was to be able to be grounded on the community voices. So one of the questions, for example, is the demographic in terms of what race, what's their household size, if they were a renter or if they were a property owner. I believe 24% were renters. If they had moved into the neighborhood, a good portion had moved into the neighborhood the last 5 years. Also, what was really important is what percentage of their household income was spent, combined household income was spent on housing. And we had a surprising, close to half of the respondents were saying that their household, they were spending more than 30%, which is the threshold for housing assistance that they would need that. So some of the trigger questions, aside from the demographic, is going through and saying, are you familiar with the urban village? And the response, 70%, was they were not familiar. Would you support the 10-minute walking distance? We had 51% return. And then we ask about MHA, mandatory housing affordability. I think the words resonated with them, even though they didn't understand it, because we had a kind of a 55% support for it. There were other elements that asked to reinforce the neighborhood plan, that had been developed, I believe, 5 or 6 years prior to 2016, and those elements were affirmed as far as multifamily housing, because in Beacon Hill, with 50% Asian and Latinos, we have larger families that actually, because they tend to, they're more family members than a nuclear family, the median income is deceiving because of the number of people contributing to the household income. And so that's how we were trying to figure out what is the need in Beacon Hill so that we on the Beacon Hill Council can appropriately respond and advocate for them. Let's see, there were also a new set of questions in terms of what are the current concerns. Social and human services came up. The air and noise pollution came up pretty high. And what we call food forests, which is basically availability of, you know, food, groceries, appropriate ethnic kinds of groceries came up. Safety came up in terms of the multimodal bicycles, cars, buses, and so forth, and security. We have highest rate of burglary in Beacon Hill.
So let's shift towards how does this relate to the MHA proposal that's in front of us?
Out of that survey material, that was administered in June 2016, back then the mayor, former mayor,
Ed Murray?
Ed Murray, thank you. Former Mayor Murray was pushing.
There's been a lot of them in the
show. was pushing very, very hard to get the community input because they wanted to put the ordinance in place. And of course, they kept saying they would slide it. So we said we would do a really fast turnaround of the survey document. And we wrote a letter to him saying, these are our findings. These are the things that our community is wanting, and we recommended some policy that will be important for us. And I apologize because we wrote two letters, one June of 2016, a second letter in February of 2017, wherein we recommended a lot of policy ideas that would work for us. Like, we wanted the highest possible MHA because our understanding is that the more, the higher our
fees.
The higher the percentage of housing that's required within a developer's building, the more, if they don't develop within, the more we're likely to get fees to do development. We also wanted some assurance as to the fees that would be collected that would be invested in Beacon Hill. The equity and growth analysis, we wanted it changed because we were designated as a high risk, high opportunity, and we're a residential area, we're not a commercial area. We also ask for putting some land in land trust so they would be exempted from the MHA designation because 1 out of 5 residents in Beacon Hill is low income. And there were other ideas like to allow our residents to develop up to 4 either attached or detached dwelling units and exempt them from the MHA fee. The reason for this is because there were 3 things that were beginning to happen. It seems as soon as the idea was introduced, people were coming down to Beacon Hill to develop. And if you look at the whole city, Beacon Hill is like probably the last cheapest place you can buy land in. You know, Ballard's gone, Fremont's gone, Rainier has been redeveloped with the light rail. And that's one. The second is we were beginning to learn that our current affordable low-income housing was not being counted by the city. Therefore, so some examples would be people who have held their property for a long time, then with the increase in other property values, their taxes would increase, and also the fact that They were not. We were not able to sustain some of our historical sites. So examples in North Beacon Hill is Port Commissioner Stephanie Bowman has a 100-year-old house, and there is no protection. There's no statement about historic housing. Our vice chair, Myra Latochik, lives in a 100-plus-year-old house that was owned by a former mayor of City of Seattle. And the Garden House, which is the oldest house in Beacon Hill, is now up for sale. And recently, we had to quickly put together a coalition of for Seattle Beacon Hill Historical Coalition so that we could attempt to talk with them about giving Beacon Hill first dibs on that house, because there's three properties in it. One is a historic pear tree orchard, and then the house itself, and then there's a garden, and there's a parking lot in the back. So we're at a place where in property values are going up quite a bit, and are not able to be able to respond. So part of that process of engagement with the city is that we met with Councilman Rob Johnson and attempted to explain these things that we wanted. And there were four or five of us in the meeting, and his response was that we needed to meet with the city. So we wound up meeting with SAMHSA staff and then met with SAMHSA again. And our ask for that is to do an amendment to a resolution that was passed by council that would distribute the money that Mayor Murray, he had sold the property right across City Hall, and to include us in that so that we can have some amount of site control. In other words, a piece of property that could be grandfathered in a land trust that we could develop. The third piece that was happening is the development in Beacon Hill started really accelerating, and we found ourselves in Beacon Hill Council chasing the developers to bring them in and orient them to what the community wanted. And quite a number of them are responsive. And one of the developers that came forward is from Pacific Northwest Housing, Tim Abel, who's the executive director. And he basically said he's trying to get four properties developed in this window before MHA passes, because he will not be able to afford, it won't pencil out, as he puts it, the grand bargain, which is you go beyond six floors to get seven and eight, and he can't afford to build that way, because again, we're a poorer community, and he won't be able to sell it. And so so it's beginning to make us you know, think more and more about what we need to do so that there will be consideration of our of the needs of our community.
So you mentioned that you were race and social justice toolkit or initiative manager. Did you have any understanding of how that was being applied in this case?
Let's roll back. My role at Seattle Center as HR manager was I was the point person of our director, Robert. That's Robert's last name. Anyway, of our director to do two things. One is ensure that everybody, no, three things. One is ensure that each of our staff members are trained on race and social justice, and there's a standardized training that we do. Second is I was responsible for coordinating and administering the management MBOs, management by objectives, because we had it for programming, for hiring and contracting. And the third is I participated in the cabinet that the city had, wherein we have representatives from different departments that come together and look at some of the systemic issues that are happening so we could do an analysis and develop a kit for it. The race and social justice, at that time when I participated, the tenets were in place. The sense of early analysis, race and social justice methodology was in place, but I don't believe it had yet been adopted by council as a resolution. So it was still in the executive branch, which is the operational branch.
Okay. Did you have any sense of how the RSJ was, RSJ being the acronym for race and social justice, how it was being applied to the mandatory housing affordability program?
Yes. There's a standard race and RET, racial equity toolkit, and the way that's applied is that whereas programs before were reviewed with what is the purpose of the program, the impact, the budgetary, there's a what they call a race and social justice lens that's applied. The race is ethnicity and at times immigration status, but the social justice speaks to age, disability, gender, and sometimes GLTBQ, gay, lesbian, so forth. So the process is to be able to model and predict the impact of whatever program is on play, and either to adjust how the program is going to be done and or put some mitigation measures, because what we're trying to prevent is adverse impact, negative impact on the population.
So in your engagement with the development that turned into drafting of the draft environmental impact statement that Beacon Council commented on, did you have any sense? Well, let me back up one step. So you clearly understand then that the point of the MHA is to develop money for subsidized housing. Is that not part of the racial equity, race and social justice kind of goal right there?
Yes. We were very excited about MHA because of the possibility of getting more low-income housing and affordable housing built so that it can meet the needs of our neighborhoods. At that time that we were going, Beacon Hill Council, we were going through the analysis, we did not know that the racial equity toolkit, let me backtrack, we assumed that the racial and equity toolkit had already been applied. And so the ideas that we were trying to move forward were issues of displacement and issues of increasing cost of housing. And we thought it was a part of the unintended impact.
So when did you become aware of the city's, the actual process that the city did for applying the toolkit to the MHA?
So as Beacon Hill Council, we have our own appeal, and we're also part of SCALE in the appeal. And it was through actually what we call crowdsourcing within SCALE, wherein we take a look and review at the significance of documents that we have received from the City of Seattle through the discovery process, that we became aware of race and social justice or racial equity toolkit related material. And also I was present at the deposition for Dan Nelson, who coordinated the interdepartmental team to review the EIS for the MHA.
Okay, we're almost at the 5 o'clock hour, so I don't think we're going to go through the RSJ documents, which I actually have the copies. The final question I'll ask is, were you surprised at what we found?
I was shocked, and I was angry because Mayor Murray had openly talked about his commitment to people of color. There were people of South Core is a collection of seven people of color housing advocates that had been actively participating in this, and it was just something I had not imagined, for lack of a better term.
Your Honor, do you want me to continue to the last second, or should
yep.
we?
You got a question?
What was the conclusion, what was the city's process that we decided, that we determined? Can you summarize it in 2 minutes?
Yes. The city process started late, which is contrary to racial and equity toolkit. They started late. There are usually 5 standardized questions. They drilled it down to 3. There used to be part of the requirement in doing RETs is to utilize plain language. They opted to bypass that because they didn't have enough time. And they actually finished their product after the final EIS was published.
And the conclusions were basically?
The conclusions from various departments is anywhere from have not seen it to have not reviewed the growth and equity analysis, which is Appendix A, to inadequate, to needs mitigation. It was all over the board.
My next series of questions is going to be going through the documents.
Just got 4 minutes.
Here's chronological. Have you seen that document?
Toby, is there an exhibit?
Yes, I'm sorry.
There's multiple copies.
I mean, is it on your list somewhere?
Yes, these are. I will let you know when I submit something that is not on the list.
But let them know the number if it is.
This is FNC 73. And what is this document? What does it reflect in the process that you just described very briefly?
This is the project plan, basically, for the different components I've talked about, wherein it actually talks about what is the goal of the analysis, the introduction, the purpose, roles and responsibilities of participants. And the participants are drawn from various departments within the city of Seattle. And they have been supplemented also with technical support for areas that need to, and there was a schedule process and an evaluation process.
Okay, this one I am not going to offer yet because it is not on anybody's list. Can you describe this document?
This appears to be the minutes of the first meeting for the interdepartmental HALA MHA EIS racial equity analysis team meeting, June 8, 2017. This is standard fare wherein a convening comes together and creates meeting norms on how they're going to operate. And a lot of this is supported from past norms that have been developed from race and social justice projects, and then it looks like an orientation, and again the standard roles and responsibilities schedule, and then there's an allocation of which department is going to work on what chapters in the MHA EIS.
So let's look at that real quickly.
Go ahead.
So the chapter overview.
Yes.
Could you just read the first 2 or 3 or 4 and tell us what they say?
So the chapter overview refers to the HALA MHA plan. So 3.1 is the housing and socioeconomics, and the alphabet OH refers to Office of Housing. 3.2 is land use. SDCI refers to Seattle Department for Construction and Inspection. 3.3 aesthetics refers to, again, the same department, Seattle Department of Construction and Inspection. 3.4, transportation, refers to SDOT, Seattle Department of Transportation. 3.5, historic resources, refers to Department of Neighborhoods. 3.6, biological resources, identifies 3 departments. Office of
Sustainability
and Environment. SPU, Seattle Public Utilities, SEDI, Seattle Department of Construction and Inspection. 3.7, Open Space and Recreation is assigned to Parks. 3.8, Public Utilities and Utilities is assigned to 3 departments. Seattle Public Utilities, Seattle SCL, I'm forgetting that, I'm going to go back to that, HSD, Human Services Department, 3.9, Air Quality and Greenhouse Gas Emissions, Office of Sustainability and Environment, and various other appendices that may be applicable across chapters, all as necessary.
All right, let's stop there. On that item, please clarify what we're doing with it. You handed it out. The witness read from it.
The City of Seattle document production number on that document is 117,550. It took quite an effort to...
I think he wants to know whether you're planning to submit it.
I don't know yet because it's not on a list. I intend to go through the entire list everything that we found in a chronological order and have Ms. Badiola explain and describe what it says, how it relates to the EIS, and then move its admission, and we'll decide then whether or not to offer this one as an exhibit.
Are there other documents in that stack that are in the same category?
I believe it's the only one, and the only reason I put it in is because it has, that's why I had to read it into the record. It's the only one that I found because it's the introductory meeting. It tells the breakout of the departments.
I don't object to this. He got it from the city, so I'm fine if he wants to admit.
Let's just put it in since she's read from it. And then we won't have any more.
Thank you, Mr. Weber.
Unmarked exhibits or unsubmitted. The rest are items that were identified for the city in advance.
Okay.
Is that the case?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right.
These are all.
Yes. The answer is yes.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Battioli, we'll see you again tomorrow. Thank you.
He's assigned numbers still.
So, do you want to move the admission of those lists too, or?
So, 121 through 125, except 122 and 123. 121, 124, and 125.
And this last one is 126?
And 126.
Yes, I'll move them.
Any objections?
I think you excluded 121, so we're still looking at that the other
way. Right, yeah, sorry. It is just the... show me the list again. 124, 125, 126.
Actually, I think we're still looking at 124 also.
Yeah. That's totally okay.
Do I hear 125, 126?
Yes, those are fine.
Okay, great. So 125 and 126 are admitted. The city will let us know on 121 and two others, 122 and 123.
No, we were fine with 122 and 123.
Yeah, those, Your Honor, there's no objection to them. It's just we physically have not provided them to you.
I was holding them for the city because if they're not in my lap, they're not even marked, so I can't ask admissibility. So I am waiting on those. Right. But we're also in the same category with then 124. Four hanging exhibits right now. 121, 122, 124, 125. No.
121 through 124.
How did one get in there? That
I think 121 through 124 are the open ones. Two because they're notes that haven't been reviewed.
Okay, so 122 is still excluded, right?
And two because they're physically not here.
All right, 21 through 24.
Right.
We'll deal with those first thing tomorrow morning, and we'll pick up with Ms. Battiola again. Thank you.
Thank you.